Welcome to the Classroom Podcast, the book club discussion on classic political philosophy. My name is Eric Nganyange. I'm your host and the student in this class, sitting here with the one and only Professor Ron Klein.
Professor, how are you?
I'm great. How are you, my friend?
I'm feeling great. Beautiful day today.
It is.
And we are talking about Plato's Dialogue, so it doesn't get better than that.
One of our favorites, to say the least.
Extra scoop of ice cream. Can't go wrong with that.
A little hot fudge on top, too. That's. I'm being greedy now.
There you go. Talking about that, I was thinking about it yesterday. Who are the best Plato's Dialogue translator beside Benjamin Jowett?
Well, there's been a lot of good ones since Benjamin, who translated all of them, which is quite unusual now. But I'm always on the lookout for better translations. One of the best ones I know of now is a man called Tom Griffith.
Okay.
And he's done four or five of the dialogues.
Is there anybody else translate all of them beside Benjamin? Well, that's a huge task.
Yeah, lifetime task. The first time they were translated by one guy was way back in Italy in the 15th century. A man by the name of Marsilio Ficino translated them all from Greek into Latin. And that became, of course, the standard for centuries. So I would guess there are some other ones, but I only know for sure of Ficino way back in the 1500s, and then Benjamin Jowett in the later 1800s. I suspect there are others, especially in Germany, but my German's kind of weak to non-existent. So
yeah, well, the best thing I like about Benjamin Jowett, for even people who will be listening to this, you can find his as a PDF format online for free.
Absolutely.
Well, Latches, that's our conversation today.
It is.
So you got these two old men,
right,
and they tried to figure out the best way to educate their son, or are they trying to figure out the art of fighting in armor for their sons?
They have a bigger goal than just teaching them fighting techniques.
Okay.
Which comes out, but not as clear as we might like. So these two gentlemen, they live in the same deme. In fact, is the same deme as Socrates lived in, which is the deme of Allopeki. It's think of our wards and precincts.
Okay.
It's a geographical division used for political situations like where you vote and who goes into the army in which campaign. So they live close together. They eat lunch together every day. Now, that seems like it's trivia, but they got that from Sparta. The Spartans, you go into the army when you're 7, you get out sort of
60,
right? And it was, you're assigned when you're old enough to actually fight, you're assigned to a group. So you fight with that group. That group eats together every day. Why do they do that? For cohesion. If you know these other people, you know how they think, you know how they, you can coordinate your fighting with them. And it's your work for the Spartans. So some Athenians picked up the habit. It didn't have the same effect, of course, because, you know, two guys aren't a fighting unit. But it had value because the fathers would talk to the sons every day.
Mm.
And remember, the fathers had famous fathers themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So Lysimachus's father was Aristides the Just. Mm-hmm. If you get the Just after your name, you know you've done well. Right?
Mm.
Or if you get the Great after your name.
Okay.
Right? So 30 years from now, if we start talking about Eric the Just, which is entirely possible, I think.
You know what? That's true.
That will make you famous, right? And deserved. Mm. So Aristides the Just and the other's father was named Thucydides, not the one who wrote the Peloponnese War, but a different one. And he was also extremely well known. So the fathers, in sitting and talking with the sons, bemoan the fact that their famous fathers, and literally Lysimachus says, sort of let us run wild.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and here's the circumstance. All Athenian men have a basic education they have to get involving, you know, learning the language, reading and writing.
Yeah.
But then music, they have to learn how to play a musical instrument. And usually a lyre, which is think of a harp that's small enough you can hold in your hands. So sort of equivalent to a modern guitar, if you want to say that, but much harder to play. And then they have what they call gymnastics, which is all kinds of bodily training. And of course, you have to have all the men have that, because that's your army. And they don't have group training for the army. Each person is required to keep themselves in really good shape, the best they can be. Okay, so fathers of these boys are talking about their great fathers and saying, you know, they were great. We turned out to be okay. The reason we're only okay is our fathers didn't pay attention to us after we got out of that preliminary education, because they were busy doing things for the city of Athens.
Yeah.
Right?
Is that common? We're seeing it. We're seeing a lot of that. The great man kids do not become great.
Yes. And historically, that's true across the board. It does happen occasionally.
Is it because the great men are so focused on the affair of what's going on in the city or what's going on in the country, and they neglect the idea of
Or their job? I mean, we can take Johann Sebastian Bach is clearly one of the greatest composers of all time, and he had several kids. Two of them turned out to be really good composers, so we could say they were great as well, but their kids didn't.
Yeah.
Okay, so it happens, right? It's very common, and Plato points this out in other dialogues too. But these fathers say, we're not going to let that happen to our kids.
Yeah.
So they're done with their education. They're mandatory education, and they're 15 or 16 years old, and they don't go into the military for the training phase until they're 18, so they got 3 years, and their families are wealthy. If, you know, it's you and me, we get done with the mandatory education, we're out there getting a job, right? We don't get to run wild even if we want to. But these guys got money, and they say, we're not going to let what happened to us happened to you.
Yeah.
We're
going
to try to further your education. And someone has told them, and that's all we know, it's Plato says, someone told us that it would be a good idea for our boys to learn this particular fighting skill, which is basically how to fight man to man. And it's different because the battles between ancient Greek armies, where each side lines up in a row, say 100 wide and 8 or 10 deep, and then they just charge at each other from a short distance, and it's like a rugby scrum, pushing and shoving, except they have spears and short swords.
Yeah. Why was that skill as important? Why did they think that skill?
Because battles not infrequently ended when one side or the other sort of panics, thinking that they're losing. And so if you lose the people around you, you are much more vulnerable. So typically what happens is once the lines are broken in some way, one side or the other literally panics and starts running away. So no matter which side you're on, whether you're on a winning side or the losing side, the whole idea of the lines smashing into other disappears, and it's the prevailing side soldiers chasing down the running away soldiers to try to dispatch them. And so it reduces to 1-to-1.
Okay.
Right? So this, theoretically, this technique is to help you when that happens.
Okay. So back then, every young man from age of 18 to 60 was required to be in the military.
Yes, it was automatic.
Was automatic.
There would be some exceptions. If you were born with some defect, although you risk being exposed if it's very serious, but if you had a defect or you injured yourself while you were a young man or something, there are some things that would exempt you.
Okay.
But they didn't come easy.
Okay.
Because we need all of the manpower we have to defend the city.
So that's why for these two fathers to make sure their kids learned these skills was so important, because they knew where their kids were going.
Yeah, since everybody goes there. So this is, they only see this demonstration.
Yeah.
Because someone mentioned it would be useful. But when they get to talking to each other and to the two other generals they brought along, remember, his fathers are there with their sons, but they invited two very powerful, influential generals.
Yeah.
Right? Nicias and Laches.
Okay. Which makes sense. If you want to talk about the art of fighting, got to bring the people who been in the front line.
Or bring the experts.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So, as I say, these are important guys in the Athenian army. They only have 10 generals. These are two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicias was also an outstanding diplomat. He probably the most famous general after Pericles in that period. So they're looking on. And so the demonstration happens. And then one of the fathers, Lysimachus, turns to the two generals and says, "We invited you here, but we haven't exactly told you what's going on.
Mm.
What we want you to do is give us your opinion of the value of this fighting technique in making our sons better men." Now, notice that changes what's up. It isn't just to make them better fighters.
It's to make them better men.
So the father, Lysimachus, says, "We chose you two guys because we know that you have the expertise to judge this and that you'll tell us the truth."
Mm-hmm.
You won't just try to figure out what we want to hear and tell us.
Yeah.
You'll tell us the truth. And then one of the generals, Nicias, says, "You know, there's Socrates over there. As long as he's here, you know, we could use his advice too.
And bring him in.
So bring him on over here."
Yeah.
So that's how he gets involved. He was an innocent bystander, and they called him in.
Yeah. So then, let me go back a little bit. Back then, would you consider it as honorable man if you never been in the military?
It would be a condition of shame.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be honorable. You're going to be shamed.
Yes.
Oh.
Even if you had a justifiable reason. You know, say you had a horrible accident and a block of marble fell on your leg and you limped and you know, you just didn't have any strength in the leg and you couldn't even lift up all the 50, 60 pounds of armor they wore.
Yeah.
I mean, perfectly legitimate reason, you wouldn't be a good soldier. Still, there's shame because you can't help defend
your country, the city. Yeah, your city.
Yeah. And remember, there was a lot more risk in those days, right? Because if you lost, your side lost, your city lost, and the conflict was serious enough, the winning side would come and capture your city, maybe tear down whatever walls you had, kill all the military-age men, and take into slavery all the women and young men. So, you know, you don't want to have that result occur because you couldn't fight in the army.
Mm.
So that's why they took this so seriously and why individual citizens would on their own go to the gymnasiums in town and work out a lot because two reasons, you have a lot better chance of staying alive in the battle. And secondly, you have a lot better chance of prevailing so that disaster, catastrophe wouldn't happen to your city.
Mm. So there was no dodging draft.
There's no draft to dodge. It's like automatic, my friend. Well, there was a while here when I was younger where there was a draft, and it was in effect in the Vietnam War. And like men, and I think this started after World War II, all young men, when you turned 18, you had to go down to the draft office and sign up, and you'd get a card. I had a card. They didn't draft women in those days, so women were free of that. But there was no way to avoid that because they checked up on people who turned 18.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the impact of Socrates that he had or still having, if he did not join the military, it would probably be a little bit lessen?
His impact?
Yeah.
It would be non-existent.
Ooh.
Nobody would listen to him. Oh, you're Socrates, the shameful man.
Oh, wow.
As it turns out, he's Socrates, the war hero. We learn that from other dialogues.
So now these two fathers bringing in Nicias and Laches, asking them the question. Now, the first question was the art in fighting in armor.
Right.
Nicias say what he thought, and Laches say another thing.
Right.
These two decorated generals did not agree.
Yep, and they're both experts.
Yeah, both experts. So they said, well, Socrates is right there. Let's bring him in. Socrates comes in. They explain what's going on, and Socrates, the first question he's asking about, are you going to accept the opinion of the majority?
Yeah, in other words, are you going to vote on what the truth is?
Yes.
And what a great question.
Very, very good question.
And it has massive ramifications, even for us in our society. But to stay with that situation, he said, we're trying to find the truth, and two experts disagree, and you're going to ask me, not an expert, to vote. So that raises a big question.
Mm-hmm.
Athens was the most radical democracy we've ever seen on the face of the earth. How did they decide issues in the assembly? All the citizens could go to the assembly, and citizens were all men, because you could only be a citizen if you could fight for the city. So they had a special theater-like space called the Pnyx that the assembly sat in. Anybody could talk about any issue. Anybody could raise any issue. And they decided what to do by vote. So that's not much different from Socrates pointing out you're trying to decide the truth by vote.
By vote.
In the assembly, that's exactly what they do all the time.
Mm.
And it's exactly what we do all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
So he's questioning about the opinion of few versus the opinion of many.
Yeah. So if it's not going to be by vote,
yeah,
how were you going to decide these issues?
By searching for the truth.
Yep. By finding the truth.
Yeah.
You don't find the truth by votes. So the question then becomes, which you picked right up on, well, here we are trying to decide this issue. How can we get to the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the dialogue's going to be all about.
Then Socrates rephrased the question and focus on what is the end, not the means.
Yes. What are you trying to accomplish?
So I was telling you this yesterday. I read this dialogue a little bit different. And the reason I did that, because you point something out on Charmides, I did not pay attention. When Socrates started asking Charmides question, this series of questions, and I was like, oh, these are great questions. But then you pointed out the conversation that we're talking is moderation, about Socrates asking about speed. Completely something different. Charmides just keep going along with it. So with this dialogue, I start paying attention every time when Socrates is changing the conversation, or what I call expanding the scope of the conversation.
That's a perfect description.
then I was like, that's his best talent.
Yeah, and going in both directions. He expands the conversation. We see that a lot in the dialogues. But he also knows how to contract the conversation so we can get to the definitive point. So he has both skills.
Mm-hmm. He's asking the question. Of course, I call that expanding the scope a little bit by talking about the end.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but would you dare not arise a prior question about the nature of the art of which we want to find the masters? I felt like, okay, that's kind of completely different question. So basically he's asking about the teacher who taught these great generals. Does that matter when we know these generals are great? They can have a bad teacher.
They can be bad teachers.
Mm.
Greatness in some skill, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily translate into greatness in teaching that skill.
Oh, now you get my attention.
Yeah, and even if you are modest in the skill, you might be a really good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important point. And in addition, Socrates very quickly changes the discussion, not only to that, but what the two fathers seem to have said to Socrates as he reports it back to them is, you have said how my boys can be the best men.
Yeah.
Right? So when you start saying to be the best men, that changes also the
scope of what do you want to talk about.
Right, because we're not talking about
the art of
how to fight.
Yeah.
We're talking about how can you be the best person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question, as he points out, what do we have to add to these two young men to make them the best?
Mm.
Well, what we have to add to them is the virtues.
Yeah.
They would be the best if they were perfectly virtuous, right? And let's talk about the virtues. They are... Help me out here.
Justice.
Wisdom, justice, sophrosyne.
Piety.
Piety and courage.
Yep.
Those are the five iconic virtues. And so Socrates says, well, you know, to figure out what those all are in one conversation is too much for us.
Yep.
So let's just pick one of them and see if we can figure out what it is so we can see if we can add it to these young men's soul, and seems appropriate to choose courage because we've been looking at a military demonstration. Mm. And we associate courage with battles and fighting, right?
Yeah.
Even now.
Yeah. So now the question, the conversation has been shifted from the art of fighting in armor to how to raise great men.
It's how to teach them virtue.
How to teach them virtue.
Okay, well, the first problem, and Socrates always points this out in the dialogues, well, we need to talk about how we can teach them virtue, but before we can do that, we have to understand what virtue is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's don't talk about the technique we might use until we know what it is we're trying to teach them. That's what gets us to a discussion of all the virtues and then just the virtue of courage.
Yeah.
We know what that is, then we have a lot better chance of inculcating that into these two young men.
Mm. Mm. When I was reading that, I was like, well, once you expanded the scope that way, Socrates, nobody's going to be able to get out. Because you will be able to ask so many questions once the scope is that big, to the point that the question that has been, and I think Nicias brought that up when he was conversating. I think he was telling Lysimachus, that, listen, you don't know this guy.
Yeah, you don't know this guy is right. Speaking of Socrates.
Yes, he was telling, I got to read that.
It's good.
It was so good. It was a perfect explanation of Socrates. What did he say? because you seem not to be aware that anyone who has an intellectual affinity to Socrates and enters into conversation with him is liable to be drawn into an argument. And whatever subject he might start, he will be continually carried around and around by him until at last he finds that he has to give an account both of his present and his past life. And when he's once entangled, Socrates would not let him go until he has completely and thoroughly sifted him. And when Socrates brought it up, when he started asking these questions about the end, the virtue, I was on Nikia's side. I was like, oh, here we go. The entangled just getting started.
Right.
And his ability to not just do that, but to bring everybody in the conversation along, because he want to make sure you agree with the question he's asking.
He insists. He doesn't go any further until you've agreed.
So he want to make sure he takes everybody. So when I was reading this dialogue, I kept following Socrates every time he changes things. And I'm like, uh-oh, trap number one, trap number two, trap number three. And you can tell, and thank to you for pointing that stuff out. Anyways, I'm getting too ahead of myself here.
But that's a really important point that you raised. It is a perfect description of what Socrates does in all 36 of the dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helps to be aware of that so you kind of know what you're getting into when you start reading them.
Yeah.
And Plato's a brilliant enough artist to alter the circumstances and the characters Socrates is talking to make it fresh and new again.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just a repeat of the same old thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. And then secondly, the fact that he gets you entangled gets you thinking. If you think at all, that will do it.
Yeah.
And we've encountered this already. You get to the dialogue ends, but the person Socrates or people Socrates has been talking to confess usually, I still don't know what that means. So what that's supposed to do, I think, that's Plato's way of saying to us who are reading it and in participating, is you got a lot more thinking to do.
Mm-hmm.
Get busy.
Yeah. So now we went from two fathers, there are two sons, and two generals.
Right.
We adding Socrates into the conversation.
Right.
So now Socrates is rephrasing and reshift a little bit the conversation of from talking about the art of fighting to the virtue. Then he brought it in the treatment of the soul.
Right.
That's another piece that I thought, okay, he's shifting the conversation again to something else. Why do you think he's doing that?
Because he wants to talk about virtue. The fathers wanted to talk about virtue, although they didn't characterize it that way. They said to make them the best men. But that's the implication.
Okay.
The virtue. Where does virtue reside in us?
Soul. And also.
In our soul. Yeah. Not in our body. So the question is, you're evaluating a bodily art here in fighting. Can that instill virtue? Well, if virtue's in the soul, no. You're training the body well, and it's maybe a very good thing to do, but it's not in itself going to instill any virtue because we've got to deal with the soul, not the body. That's my excuse for not going to the gym.
You're taking care of your soul?
I'm home taking care of my soul.
And there was a long period of time there after Nikias said what he said about Socrates. He completely stayed quiet through the conversation. It was just Socrates and Laches. He did not talk until almost to the end of the dialogue. Was it because he understood Socrates, how he works, and he did not want to get entangled into that?
He didn't want to screw up what Socrates was doing. Plus, I have a suspicion he was amused.
Oh.
Right? Because remember, as we get near the end of the dialogue, the two generals, Nicias and Laches, they get kind of chippy with each other, right? Yeah. they're criticizing the other guy, which is not something you'd expect to from two military colleagues. Mm-hmm. They really kind of got after each other. And so I think Nicias, as the more well-known and powerful one, just wanted to stay out and let Laches go through the process by himself. And he could, at the same time, be amused because he's seen Socrates work. He's been in conversations with Socrates. Okay. So he wants to see how it goes.
Because I was thinking more like, I know what this guy is about to do. I'm not going to be part of this buffoonery. I'm staying out of it. And now you say, because he was the most famous one, he probably did not want to be made look like a fool.
Yeah, he already had that happen to him at least once. But he'll jump in again. Right?
Yeah.
But only after Socrates and Laches have gone around and around about the issue of courage. Yeah.
I thought Socrates introduced so many things in this dialogue, it's easy to get confused.
Yes. Even though it's a short dialogue.
It's very short dialogue, but there's so many questions he put it in there. Like the question of, okay, if these are the great people that you can take advice from, we need to figure out who taught them. Is that really important, Socrates? But I think what you pointed out is I think that's more crucial, that they might be great, but can they teach somebody else to be great?
Right.
Yeah. Then Socrates is going back to his favorite question, to define things.
Correct.
Whatever you want to talk about it, let's first define it.
Yeah, because we have to know what it is before we can really discuss it.
Is it possible, Professor, you might know something, but you cannot define it?
That's a really interesting question. I don't have a snappy answer for that, because it's still a question that's a live question among philosophers, certainly theologians, neuroscientists. There's a bunch of people involved in that discussion, and it involves that difficult word, know. Mm. What does it mean to know something?
Something.
And so opinions are still all over the place, but that question traces right back to Socrates.
Because I hear this a lot. People say, if somebody cannot explain something to you in 5 seconds, then they don't know what they're talking about. Sometimes I sit back and say, well, there's a certain thing you might know, but you might have a hard time to explain. And once you start giving examples, Socrates will say examples is not a definition.
Right. And they encounter that right away. It seems to me, just based on what I've read and trying to think it through, is you can have some knowledge that you can't articulate.
Mm.
So if I ask you right now, do you know how to drive a car? Your answer is sure.
Yeah.
So what is it to drive a car?
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, we could, all of us that drive cars, can sort of stumble through, well, you do sort of do this and that and the other. But what is it to drive a car?
Mm-hmm. Finally, they get to the question of virtue. Then Socrates asking the main question he always asks, what is courage?
Mm-hmm.
That's when funny stuff happens.
Really, it gets very interesting very quickly. And, of course, what's the first definition? Well, I think it's Laches who says, that's easy, Socrates. When you, and he's a general, remember, when you put a man in the line of battle and he stays there and fights and does not run away, that's courage. So then it's Socrates' turn.
Yep. That's another place I stopped after I read a little bit and I stopped. And I felt also on that area, Socrates kind of expanded the scope of courage instead of focusing on the military part of courage. Because I think that's what the conversation was.
It's where it started.
Yeah. And I feel like Socrates wanted to get the definition of the word courage in general that it will fit in everything.
That's precisely the point.
Yeah.
Right? Because
Was that, Professor? And I kept thinking, was that a red herring?
Oh, getting back to fallacies, which the red herring would be
in terms of him asking just the general meaning of courage instead of, okay, Socrates, we're talking about military. I felt like Lacha should stop Socrates right there and be like, listen, we are talking about military courage. We are not worrying about everything else. Can we just define that one piece?
Okay. So how does Socrates respond to that? What he does is he questions Laches. Well, you know, you gave me the example of putting this guy in the battle line and having him stay there and fight and not run away as courage. So what about the Scythian archers who are horsemen?
Yeah.
Right, they're cavalry. And they would charge up to the other army and shoot arrows at them, and then they'd run away. And then they come back and run away. So then Lacha says, yeah, but you're talking about cavalry, and I'm talking about infantry. Mm-hmm. So then Socrates says, well, you remember back in the Persian Wars when the Spartans, arguably the best infantry in the world at that time, fooled the Persians by pretending to panic and run away. And so they started running away, and the Persians broke up into individuals chasing individuals. Yeah. And then the Spartans, on a signal, suddenly formed their battle line again and turned on the completely disorganized Persians and cut them to ribbons. Mm. So you can't use the argument that they didn't have courage to do that. So it's not just standing and fighting.
Yep.
There's other ways you can fight and be courageous. Then Socrates says, well, you know, we use that word courage a lot.
Yep.
And we can use it in the sense of a person's really courageous in the way they deal with an illness. And he agrees. And how about how they deal with poverty? We can see they face that with courage. Or, you know, there's other examples. So we have a whole range, whole scope, as we've been talking, of situations when we actually use the word courage to describe what we see.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, one last thing. If we're using the same word to apply to all of those cases, there must be something in common with all the cases that we apply the word courage to it.
And that's where Socrates was trying to go.
Yes, he says, there's got to be something in common or we wouldn't use the word courage for all those different things.
Because I marked that part
as
entanglement number one.
Well put.
And I say, Laches, please don't get caught in this one. Because Socrates say, and I'm not going to read the whole paragraph, what he says, but pieces of that, that's why I was like, oh, this is a trap. He said, and not only who are courageous in war, but who are courageous in pain or fear, but might contend against desire and pleasure. That's way too big of the scope to find one definition.
I would disagree with you a little bit. We actually do use the word courage, all right? Let me give you a simple example from my experience when I first moved back. It was in 2008. A first caucus I'd ever attended, right, because I was too young and they didn't have them when I left for Michigan. And this was just a pact. At some point, they always ask, does anybody want to stand up and speak for a candidate? For some reason, the governor of Minnesota was there. Don't ask me why. He stands up and speaks. Then the mayor of Mason City, who was Roger Bang, I think, at the time, he stands up to support his candidate. And then on the other side of the room, a woman sort of hesitantly stood up, and she was shaking like a leaf. The paper in her hand that she was going to read from was shaking. She started to speak, and her voice was trembling, and she didn't speak very loudly. And she didn't speak too long. But I looked at that and said, what courage that woman has to do something that terrifies her.
Mm-hmm.
She did not want to get up and speak. Right?
Yeah.
It would have been easy to just sit there and observe the scene. Despite everything, she stood up and did it.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, if you ever want to see an example of courage, there it is. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's not military courage. That's political courage, I guess.
And he mentioned that.
Yeah. And again, the scope is wide, but we use the same word.
Yeah.
So if it's the same word, the same concept must apply to all of those, and we have to figure that out.
Yeah. I wrote my note there. When Laches agreed with Socrates on when he expanded our scope, I was like, big mistake. And I'm talking to Laches on this. I say,
right.
Laches, you should take him back and not allow him to expand the scope of the conversation. He's tying you in the knot. He knows you will not get out.
But he knows you have to go there.
Yep.
To make a useful discussion.
Yeah. Of course, I understand what Socrates is trying to do. He's trying to get as much clarity as possible of what they're talking about.
Correct.
And to make sure they all understand, and that's why he's constantly asking the questions, do you agree?
Yes.
Then Socrates injected the word wisdom in the conversation. Because you could have virtue of courage without having word virtue of wisdom.
Socrates is kind of heading to the idea that all virtues are the same.
What do you think?
It's a fascinating topic. And not to give away the ending of the dialogue, but he's saying each virtue has to do with knowledge. And he'll say courage has to do knowledge or wisdom about what you should fear and what you should not fear, don't have to fear.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So wisdom is that knowledge. So that fits in. Piety, remember Euthyphro, you have to have the knowledge of what the gods want from us.
Mm-hmm.
Sophrosyne, you have to have the knowledge of what kind of soul you have.
Yeah.
And what am I leaving out?
Did you say justice?
No, I didn't say justice. So justice is the knowledge of how you should properly treat other people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So they all involve the term knowledge. So that's sort of his argument for all the virtues are based in knowledge.
Yeah.
Now, just before you get too comfortable with that, in some dialogues he argues that it's not knowledge at all. Right? Because if it was knowledge, we could teach people.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what knowledge is. Knowledge is something that's teachable. On the other hand, Socrates occasionally defends the view, as in Protagoras, for example, that you can't teach the virtues, which means they're not knowledge. Because if they're knowledge, you can teach them.
You can teach them.
So that's Plato's way of getting you and me to think.
You have to think through.
And he's done a good job on us.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They kept going back and forth about courage. And then Nicias jumped in. Actually, when he jumped in, he was very confident. Then he defined what courage is. Nicias said, courage is the knowledge of that which inspires fear or confidence in war or in anything.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first definition. Now the conversation is between Socrates, Laches, and Nicias. And Laches did not understand that definition. Socrates jumped in and asking Nicias to clarify everything. That's where I lost with Nicias.
Okay. I don't know if we have passed this point, but the second definition that gets given is endurance.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Yep. That's the second definition so, given
by Laches.
Yeah.
So that's endurance. Right? Mm-hmm. So then Socrates asks, well, it gives examples. Do you mean this kind of endurance, that kind of endurance? And they decide that maybe it's something between endurance and perseverance.
Yeah.
And Socrates asks him for both of those, is it more virtuous to endure wisely? Is it more virtuous to endure or persevere wisely or foolishly?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a loaded question because the answer is obvious.
Yep.
Wisely. Well, it's wisely, of course. We admit that wisdom is more admirable than foolishness.
Yep.
Right? So that's another reason to accept. And wisdom, in a sense, is something to do with knowledge. That's a contentious issue in all of the dialogues. But we know knowledge and wisdom go together somehow. So can you, well, let's put it this way. Here's a case. If you're a bank robber, is it wise to persevere in that? And the answer is no,
no,
because it's not admirable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's bad on the face of it. So that's foolish. They get the definitions coned down to its the wisdom or knowledge about something.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can go to, Socrates leads them there, of course, goes to, well, in a battle, let's go back to the military, what kind of knowledge would be useful? Well, the knowledge of what's harmful or evil or what's helpful or good.
Yeah.
So, and then comes the coup de grace, so to speak. Well, yes, they agree that knowledge of what's evil or fearful and the knowledge, as opposed to the knowledge of what's helpful and good. In that case, to know what all the goods are and all the evils are, to be able to have the specific knowledge for courage, you have to understand all the virtues. We've come right back to the very first part of where it's a big circle.
Yeah.
Well, we started out trying to understand all the virtues and decided we couldn't do it, so we chose one, but that just led us back to the question of how do we know all the virtues? And that's a technique that Plato uses once in a while. You start someplace and then you end up back at the same place. Think Euthyphro again.
Yep.
Right? And he says, well, we're back same place, Euthyphro.
I got to go.
I remember there's an appointment I have to, and he almost literally runs away. So that can be frustrating. And in essence, that conclusion that Socrates pulls out of this also ends this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Nikki has brought it up, something was very interesting to me, and I don't know, I never thought about that before. Between fearless, courageous, and rashness.
Oh, yeah.
He brought the awareness of danger. So if you don't have the knowledge of danger, whatever you're doing is rashness.
Right. It's reckless behavior because you literally don't know what you might encounter.
That's not a courage.
That's not courage. That's rashness. And our friend Aristotle, student of Plato, remember, picks up that when he's defining courage. Courage is what comes between rashness, just rushing in regardless, and cowardice, where you don't rush in at all.
Yeah.
Right? You got to find the sweet spot in between for you. It could be a different spot for everybody. So that's the same point that Socrates is making with the argument you just rehearsed for us.
So then we get close to the end here. These two fathers, I felt bad for them. Do you think they accomplished anything through this dialogue? Did they get close to where they started?
I think they far surpassed where they started. They were given by Socrates to understand the scope of the issues.
Yeah.
As you said, there's expand the scope. We're not just talking about fighting. We're talking about virtues. That's a whole different field.
Yeah.
We've talked through a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
We've found out that we don't really understand very much, but we got some of the pieces, sort of. And the fathers there, they're not dumb guys by any mean. And the boys are listening, by the way. And they knew who Socrates was. If you remember, they get one word in the dialogue, both of them at the same time, say yes.
Yes, that's it.
So because one of the dads asked him, oh, we hear you talking about Socrates sometimes at our communal lunches. Is this a guy?
Mm-hmm.
And they both say yes.
Yeah. Right?
So there's hope that the two young men who apparently have heard Socrates before, the fathers who have now got a much bigger view of what the issues are, plus some discussion of what the answers might be.
Yeah.
They are furnished with materials to continue thinking about these things in the same way that Plato wants the two of us to think about those issues.
Yeah. Well, Professor, that's all I have. So did we know what's the definition of courage after we read all this?
Well,
if
we took their summary conclusion, you know, it certainly has plausibility. Mm-hmm. It's knowing what you should fear and what you should not fear.
Yeah.
Right, and acting accordingly.
Well, thanks, Professor.
Thank you, my friend.
All right.